Norman's a sociologist, and he was formerly a lecturer at Newcastle University in the social studies department there.
Yes, with John Davis.
Are we both there together?
Yeah.
And he's here with John. I think you became head of religious studies.
I did. Somewhat to my surprise.
Newcastle University. And then Harry is a friend of John and Norman. And Norman, I think you had a particular interest in working class communities, mm-hmm. and you've had a variety of international fellowships. The two books were published in 1993, which particularly impressed me. They were Families Without Fatherhood, which has recently been continually republished, I think, since then. And Rising Crime and the Dismembered Family. And Norma's really going to speak to us about the breakdown of the family and the impact on society, particularly the growth of incivility and crime. He's the author of many books which are actually in our library. There's just some of them. They're not all here. And a number of us have read them. I think some of us also have heard of the book you wrote with A.H. Halsey called English Ethical Socialism. Mm-hmm. And Frank Field said of this book, apparently, that it was like a medieval Bible. It should be nailed to the wall of every place where the Labour Party meets.
Yes. They never took it up, actually.
But as you're here, Norman, as he said to me himself, he takes the 1946 view of Labour Party values, which is rather different to the trendy Islington values of today. It's not unusual today for people to point to the breakdown of the family and its impact on society, but Norman was saying these things long before it was politically acceptable. So with that, Norman, I'll hand over to you.
Okay. Well, in Families Without Fatherhood, I made two points. One, that from the point of view of being brought up in a family that wasn't the traditional Christian family, and in the book, I think we say, which I wrote with George Erdos, I said it was written by a not very conscientious member of the Church of England and a practicing Jew. So we'll call this type of family the Catholic family, right? The model of the family of the Catholic Church. And in that book, we looked at the impact on the child of being brought up in one kind of household arrangement rather than another household arrangement. And really, whatever vaguely respectable research you look at, there's the gradient that on the average, the child does best in the when he's conceived and brought up by his own two biological parents, who before they had the child have undertaken to abide by the rules of the Christian family. But I also was interested in something which I think is important, but it's never really been taken up, but I regard it in a sense as the Dennis thesis, that the impact is just as important or very important on all men, whether they're brought up in a Christian family or not, in the Catholic family or not, what they call a Catholic family. Because what had happened is the breakdown of the Christian family means that young boys are no longer treated from the very earliest time, from being babies, before they can speak, being treated so that they will grow up to be motivated to take a lifetime responsibility for the results of their sexual activity. That was a tremendous project that was put upon all boys. and whatever age, when they were 8 and when they were 15, when they were 16, they were always being judged by everybody, by the tram conductor or by the park keeper or by the local policeman or by Auntie Ian or whatever, as doing well if they look as if they are going to become responsible fathers, and as doing badly as they're not. Well, that, of course, is all dismantled. Very rapidly, from the middle of the 1950s, I actually, in my mind, dated from Norman Mailer's The White Negro, which at the time I thought was very, when I was a young lad, like, you know, I thought was a thing worth reading. Very seriously, and I'm not being falsely modest here, you're going to be listening to, somebody the kind of rocket of research as compared with, you know, Robert Stevens, George Stevenson College, along at Wylam there, where he bodged up the local steam engines, you know, and a lot of years later, 1829, he put the rocket on the tracks. But anyway, in 1936, the Silver Link comes past on the same line. I think it was 1965, I'm sorry, not 1960. So I am very conscious, whenever I come to visit Colin, that he's got a tremendous operation of everything that I would like to have been able to do, would like to do now, but I'm just left with plastic boxes, as I say, where there's unfiled cuttings and boards through as best I can on the Excel as I'd gradually guess and go blimey, try to make sense of the technology and so forth. But anyway, I must say, I feel a bit stupid having put on there a copyright, you know, because you do all of these things so much. But the explanation is that, in fact, I started to do this work for an organisation called the Institute for Civil Justice or something down in London. It's a Tory think tank. So I thought, you know, you never know with these people, they all be. Right? But I trust you, of course, right? So that doesn't apply at all to you. You happily. You've got full permission here. It's recorded. You've got to use that exactly where you like. If, in likely event, that you don't have something altogether better already, right? Which I expect you do have. In colour and everything. because I was doing this work with the Institute of Social Justice or something, and I was already bringing, it was by coincidence, I was already bringing this stuff up to date for that reason. I thought that I would concentrate this morning on this aspect of the effect of the breakdown of the family on social order. In my book, the most plausible explanation being that the family has broken down, and the effect is through the failure now to socialise young men. And at certain levels of society, a lot of the slack can be taken up by other means. But in many parts of society now, the slack can't be taken up, and the result is, in fact, social chaos. Colin said, have you got a title for your talk? And I said, no, I don't have a title for the talk. But what I've got in mind is England from law and order paragon to law and order basket case in two generations. And I believe that to be so. Now, the first... on page one, you see there the record of police recorded crime from 1950. It's actually from 1957. I made it 1958 on the Excel so I could get 2007 on the diagram, but I've lost the 2007. Anyway, from 1858, when crime figures were first collected, this is police recorded crime, and you can see that it's a scarcely believable line. And when I was teaching, and John will vouch for this, I'm sure, when we were teaching in our last days in the Department of Social Studies in the 1980s and 1990s, our colleagues and academics generally were adamant and consensual that this was not happening, that that line was not going up in that way in terms of real crime. It was an artifact of the statistics, and it was an expression of moral panic. Now, one of the reasons that you do these kind of, one does this kind of talk, is you say, well, show me how I'm wrong, and I'm open to be shown how I am wrong. But when I read social commentators, when I see the results of social surveys in the 19th century, then they are all totally consistent with this picture of the line being down there. In one of the books, I quote Engels in The Condition of the Working Class in 1844. And his proof that society is breaking down in 1844 English society and the revolution is imminent is because he's reading the Manchester Guardian, and there's no fewer than three cases in the past week of crime where there's this Irishman beating his wife. And you say, well, what proves that that's the lines down there more effectively than that? I was just reading P.G. Woodhouse at the minute, and one of the stories is Smith goes to Clapham, and there's a big fight in Clapham, and the policeman turns up, this is 1909, and the policeman turns up and says, what's going on here then? And P.G. Woodhouse says, there's nothing like the policeman's what's going on here then to stop all kinds of... Well, you know, I mean, he's a popular author, and he cannot be, you know, his humour depends upon kind of bizarre, you know, but based upon a kind of realistic report of what's going on. One of the things I quote, I think, in Rising Crime, this member of family, is one of the first talking pictures was a bulldog Drummond with Ronald Coleman, about 1929 or something, 1930. And Ronald Cole, Bulldog Drummond's just back from the war. And he, you see that I always prepare about 26 pages, and I very, very rarely get past the first. So Bulldog Drummond's back from the war, and he's in his club with his valet. I think the piece was called Bulldog Drummond's, played by Ronald Coleman. And this valet, I think, was played by somebody called Claw. And he said, you know, it's very boring, very boring. He says, so we put an advertisement in the Times saying, you know, anybody that wants to hire somebody for adventure, I'm available, and so forth. So you next see them in the club with these piles of letters, and they're going through the letters. And then they get this letter that says, I must see you down at the White Hart at Godalming at midnight. I've got this very serious problem. Sign. She says, oh, that sounds like an interesting young lady. So they go down to Godalming, and they knock on the door, and the woman comes to the door, the girl comes over to the door, they go in, and she says, what's the matter, dear? What's your trouble? How can I help you? She says, well, my parents have been kidnapped, and they're being held in the big house up the hill there at Godalming. And Ronald Coleman says, in 1929, he says, oh, come on. She's American. She says, my dear, this is not America. These things don't happen in England. Well, again, there's all these audiences in Sunderland, right? And they're going to say, oh, you know, what a load of rubbish. That corresponded roughly with what they... Eh? And there's no evidence that when people were produced, when the criminal statistics for England and Wales were being produced, that anybody was saying, well, those figures are obviously ridiculous. Right? So anyway, if you have got cases where you come across that, let me know. But what you see there is that between the wars, you have the increase in crime. Okay. By the way, from 1857 down to 1911, crime actually falls. Now, I won't look to the page, but you'll see that, well, you already know, that in the 19th century, the population of this country was growing rapidly. And you'll also see in among the papers, as criminologists will say, well, what is the population at risk? There might have been many more, there might be more young people, the people at risk. Crime was actually going down in absolute numbers in the 19th century, in spite of the rise in population, and in fact the population being so rich in potential criminals, that is the young males. Anyway, it goes up in the... And everybody in the 19th century said, well, of course crime is going down. The society is getting richer. We're opening all these fine art galleries, these parks. Got compulsory education now. We've got the vote for the town labourer and then for the country labourer. We've got the new county boroughs and, right, we've got... And so, of course, it's going down. But you see that it begins to go up then between the wars, but after the war, in the 1950s, it begins to come down. So for a few years in the 1950s, all of these problem statistics begin to be modified. And everybody thinks in the 1950s that we're getting back to normal. But here, Norman Mailer produces The White Negro, and Bill Haley's Comets make this film. And astonishingly, at the cinema in Tottenham Court Road, where is it? These young people started to dance in the aisles. As a matter of fact, it's interesting, in my lifetime, I used to go to Butlins with my wife and with her family, coal miners and so forth. And by an astonishing coincidence, this year, out of all the millions of photographs that ever taken at Butlins, somebody has picked out a Butlins photograph for Christmas cards in Fenix and so forth. And this shows my father-in-law in the Nobbly Me competition. So it was a great family affair. But I assure you that it was very... And when I used to making notes all the time on this phenomenon of Butlins, right? And one year, it's all this family thing, and the next year... It's totally different because there's all of these things for the youth, right? And the youth and the families are separated out. So something quite distinct happened. And you see that from the middle of the 1950s, but then very rapidly at the time of what was obviously the Cultural Revolution, so we've got this absurd thing about the city of culture today, right? And what's the great thing about English culture? That is, we've got Ringo Starr on the top of... Well, that goes back to the Cultural Revolution, right? And now, again, I was remembering in Selly Road High Street, that's just where the University of Birmingham is, and I heard this funny kind of thing on somebody's transistor. We didn't have one. I was advanced technology for me, I didn't have one. It was a long time ago. And it was saying, yeah, yeah. I thought that's a nice sound, that's an unusual sound. But anyway, I also date a lot of what happened from just me hearing that. And you can see that then you've got this astonishing rise in the number of police reported crimes. Until it reaches actually 6 million. And the history, academically, is that rise is denied by academia. Really, it's a serious matter. And denied, it was consensual. I think the introduction to one of the books, I think I say that my objective is to help to break the consensus that it is not happening, right? And if I make an even small contribution to that, I'll regard that book as being worthwhile. But But you'll confirm that, won't you, John, that it was all moral panic. It was the great days of moral panic in academia. And whenever the crime came down for a little bit, oh, the crime is down 40% on the previous year, right? Aren't we doing well? I say, what about 40% on the previous? What was it, 3 years ago? What's it on 3 years ago? So that by the late 1980s, the yearly increase in crime was several magnitudes larger than the total amount of crime for decades in the 19th century and in the first half of the 20th century. And what we have today, of course, is, oh, well, it's the rise in crime is due to the change in recalling, right? The change of the system in the late 1990s, right? Well, all you've got to do is to say, well, all right, that's on the old system. That's where the dotted line is, right? That's on the new system. So all you've got to do is to drop that down to the old, make them equivalent. And that's not to say that explains this apparent rise in crime. And what you get all the time now, you've got this wonderful access now to data, haven't we? Absolutely remarkable. We thought it was marvellous in 1971 when the first social trends came out. It was paper about years ago, right? And we thought, well, lots of questions are now settled because we know what the data are. Right? It's not a matter of opinion anymore. Now that you've got all of these data, there's so many commentators that seem to take not a blind bit of notice of it, and there's so many people that are invited who are invited simply because they have some kind of crude, unbased scepticism about the figures, and they say anything like, oh, well, there's the change in definition, there's the change in blah, 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 you know, and just say, well, these... So this is postmodernism, of course. Why bother to study statistics when one person's opinion is as good as another, is as sound as another, not only in terms of value, but also in terms of fact. I used to say to my students a few years ago, when they came with the postmodernists, I said, out of the room, right? And then outside, I said, well, how many chairs are in that room? Right? And somebody said, 16, 13, right? So, anyway, I said, well, come and count them, right? And it's a matter of definition. If you don't count, you know, one without a back as a chair, well, just define what unit you're, right? But it was we lived through an astonishing period of the degradation of public opinion. John Stuart Mill in On Liberty says that public opinion in London must lead because public opinion in London is the most effective, the most efficient, best based on... I think public opinion in London now is... It doesn't deserve those accolades at all. So anyway, that's something that some people get excited about, but not me. Now at the same time as this is going on, so this is on page 2, there's the great, there's a wonderful passage in Burke, Edmund Burke, which I think I've put in one of the books as well. If I can see where it is, I'll quote it. That's right, it's here. Right? Burke said, men are qualified for civil liberty in exact proportion to their disposition to put moral chains upon their own appetites. Liberty, if people are going to be in a society where liberty is maximised, optimised, men are qualified for civil liberty in exact proportion to their disposition to put moral chains upon their own appetites. In proportion as their love of justice is above their rapacity. In proportion as their soundness and sobriety of understanding is above their vanity and presumption. In proportion as they are more disposed to listen to the counsels of the wise and good in preference to the flattery of knaves. Society cannot exist unless a controlling power upon will and appetite be placed somewhere, and the less of it there is within, the more there must be without. it is ordained in the eternal constitution of things that men of intemperate minds cannot be free. Their passions forge their fetters. Right? Now, while all of this is going on, everybody's free to do what they like, and democracy means precisely that we do what we like, and we, my opinion is as good as yours. While this is going on, academia and the media, manned and womaned by the 1990s by the children of the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, are all saying it's not happening. And you can see that on page 2, that while all of this happening, the external control is also being diminished. And that's the fall in the police officer numbers there on page 2 from 1993 to 2000. Dropping from about 128,000 to about 124,000. A few years before, my son had been wanting to join the police. And I said, I don't think you can do it, John. I've got the personality to take insults galore, right? But I said, I don't think you've got the personality to take insults galore. And it's just a bad, bad business now to be a policeman on the street. And all you get is a lot of cheek from your boss. So on page 3, it's just the same point that you look there in the second half of the 19th century. You see that crime, with a rapidly rising population, with well-established police forces, the number of crimes remains low and stable. And on page 4, I've taken it from the millions scale to the thousand scale, and you see that it just varies about 90,000, but on a declining trend. The trend line is there as well. That's on page 4. Now, in the glorious second half of the 20th century, with rising standard of living, with more and more educational opportunities, with the finest brains and skills of the country, town planners and so forth, providing better housing and better places to live, you find that crime rises to a figure of more than 6 million. And of course, it's a rapidly rising trend line. Now, one of the things that then happens is that we are gifted the British Crime Survey. Is this all right? Is it going on all right like this? We gifted the British Crime Survey. And that is no doubt a better way to calculate how many crimes there are in any particular year. There's no doubt that the police recorded crimes, those data I've just been referring to, are a very poor measure of the amount of crime in any particular year, because it's an enormous dark figure. But I think the only plausible reason that you get this increase in the known figure is because the phenomenon that it's measuring is really increasing. And that there's no dramatic change year by year in the proportion between the known figure and, of course, the by definition, the unknown figure. The British Crime Survey does tell you much better what is happening year by year, and it also tells you what's happening in a particular year, and also tells you what's happening year by year. So it's a better figure. And this is, you'll know the British Crime Survey, of course, probably better than I do. But in the 1980s, they had one every 3 or 4 years. In the 1990s, every 2 or 3 years, and they now have it every year. And they ask people whether they've had any of these experiences, any of these incidents, these BC, British Crime Survey crimes. But as it happens, the British Crime Survey crimes are now back to what they were in 1981. So you never hear a Home Office spokesman or a Home Office minister now talking about crime, excepting to say that we're back to where we were in 1981, as if 1981 was year zero. Of course, it is year zero as far as the British Crime Survey is concerned. And there's this sense of satisfaction that's inculcated into the public that we're back to normal. And crime has come down, and the fault lies with stupid people like John Davis there, and like me, doddering old people, right, that dare not go out at night because they fear crime. It's the fear of crime that is the problem, and not crime itself, because we're back to where crime was in 1981. And the police now talk about managing expectations, that people expect to be better than 1981. They've got to manage expectations and manage demand, just as if, you know, with the difficulties that you're having at Marks and Spencer's, just as, if the managing director says, oh, well, the shelves are not being filled and so forth, right? And our main job as a firm is to manage expectations. You mustn't expect that you'll have a lemon mousse, right? Exactly the same. But anyway, they blatantly say this, we're managing expectations, we're managing demand. But on the basis that crime is really no longer a problem, or it's the standard problem, because we're back to 1981. I think that on the other page, you can see what I do is to put on the same, that's on page 8, I put the same, on the same scale, the police recorded crime, which is the bottom set of bars, and the BCS crimes, and I think that any reasonable person would say that it's unlikely that this 1981 line, right, if you're going to continue it back, if you did have the information, would be at the same height as that line, okay? So if you go back, you're getting back on a declining line, and therefore the figure today is very much higher than any figure 20 or 25 years ago. Okay? Now, one of the figures... the figures that go into the general crime number are very diverse. And there have been important changes in definition. At the end of the 1990s, there was an important change in definition of what constituted violence against a person. And the result was that violence against the person went up nearly 20%, but purely on the new definition. So this gives a great opportunity for spokespeople to say, oh, well, it's all a matter of the definition, okay? But there's one figure, and this figure is where public opinion has changed, so that they're much more likely to report that there's a crime, like rape or like domestic violence or something. But there's one figure that hasn't changed in definition. Public attitudes haven't changed much about it. There's no evidence that public attitudes have changed. There's no reason why you should think that they would. There's been no change in the reporting rules. When the reporting rules changed at the end of the 1990s, whereas you did have that jump in the general crime, there's no difference in the old rules and the new rules for robbery. So robbery is a very good figure. For that reason, it's also a very good figure for another reason, and that is much of the decline in crime is due, clearly due neither to the police nor to any stabilisation or rise, much less rise, in civic virtue. One of the main reasons the cars are stolen, while there's a drop in car crime, is because the manufacturers made it very difficult to pinch a car. One of the reasons the burglary drops is because people are staying in at night to see that the burglars can't break, right? And at the very least, putting on locks and bolts and, you know, double locks on the windows and seeing that everything is locked when they go out and having alarms and so forth. But robbery is on the streets and you can't do much about it. What's what the lads are doing on the streets? And that's, it depends then largely on what the police can do to control it. So robbery is a very good figure for those two reasons. Now, if you look at robbery, that's on page 9. The first diagram shows that it took a century and a half to reach the first 60,000 robberies a year. Right? Going back to the, when the figures were first collected in 1857. As I said, 1858 was just a bodge job on trying to get the... Right? Oh, well, I did work there, right? I did get the 2007 figure on there. And you see, you can see that it took a century and a half to reach the first 60,000 robberies. Now, robbery dropped in 1893 in England and Wales below 400 a year for the first time. Now, nobody said, when they were looking at those figures of robberies 400 a year, that's ridiculous because I know he was robbed and so forth, okay? So this was accepted as a reasonable figure. It dropped below 400 in 1893 and it never rose above 400 again until 1940. So we're talking about 400 for all that, those decades. And then again, with the Cultural Revolution, with the breakdown of the family, with lots of other things as well, I mean, all I'm saying is the breakdown of the family is the most plausible social cause. Robbery rises rapidly until the middle of the 1990s. It reaches 60,000. Now, if you look at the over the page at 10, you'll see that it took from 1857 to 1994 to reach the figure of 60,000 robberies a year for the first time. It only took 7 or 8 years to reach the next 60,000. So that by the early 21st century, there were 121,000 robberies. But again, don't worry. It's only your fear of crime that makes you think that robbery is a problem, because robbery has come down by a certain percentage, depending upon the year that you take. So it has come down, but it's come down to 100,000, right? And that's good, right? Accepting that it bears no relation to what it was in the 1950s or the 1960s or the 1970s. And no relation at all, of course, with the time of the much despised, by the way, Victorian morality. By the way, I'd also say that Engels, when he puts out his new edition of, a new print, of the condition of the working class in England in 1844. He puts out a new one in 1893, right? And he writes an introduction to it. Now, this is a time when we're teaching kids in the department who think that 1844, Engels is describing England in 1977. Right? But what Engels says in 1893 is that, of course, all of these conditions have been transformed. None of this is any longer true, right? that the English bourgeoisie, unless the too clever by half smart aleks of the continent, who thought they could dispose of religion, the English bourgeoisie, with Israelitish cunning, set up the Salvation Army, got people to go into the chapels. Right? And here we have now this docile, productive English working class. Right? So I want to say, this is the time of Victorian morality. Now you'll see also on page 11 that when you take this crime that doesn't depend upon people simply making more physical precautions, it doesn't, this crime that all, you know, burglary, the decline in burglary and car crime and so these mass crimes are not due to people becoming more virtuous at all, not due to police activity, it's people becoming more careful. But if you look at this robbery, then you'll see we're by no means back to where we were in 1981. That robbery is still far in excess on the British Crime Survey for the figure in... So page 12, you just skip. But I just note there, the kind of question you get asked, well, what about the population? Well, there you see the population growing throughout the 19th century and then in the 20th century. But you see that the number of potential criminals, that is young men aged 15 to 24, actually I've only got the note, the 15 figure there, but it's a good index. It would be a kind of mammoth job to get the figure that I want. But that's a pretty good proxy. The population at risk remains the same, right? So it's no good saying, oh, well, it's because we've got a bigger population at risk, because we don't have a bigger population at risk. And on page 14, you see as a percentage of the population, not just in absolute numbers, but as a percentage of the population, you see that the population at risk, that is young men, in that figure of, suggested by that figure of men and boys and girls, 0 to 14, has dropped substantially as a proportion of the population. Well, the other stuff is just bread and butter to you, and you've got them much better than I've got them. So look at the breakdown of the family. Now, the essential feature of the English institution of the family. So all of these books are really about one institution. What's happened to the different institutions? The police, the church, right? The family. The core of the institution of the family is not getting dressed up in a dress and going into a church or going to its registry office and hearing a few words and saying yes. Okay? The institution is essentially a set of constraints, a set of efforts that result in men and women having sexual intercourse only under the conditions of their acceptance of their obligation, in a real way, that they're going to look after their own children. I see they've changed the definition. They're not talking about children in care anymore, because that's because of what happens to children in care. That's now a solid word. They now talk about children that are being looking after, don't they? Have you seen that change in the last few? Just to change, right? So this institution of saying, look, you have sexual intercourse, when you put yourself under the obligation of this institution of marriage, and you don't have, because otherwise bad things are going to happen. When people say now, Brown says, my leader says, Britishness. I say, what the? Britishness meant, you know, if you want to see what the kind of, you know, a bit of Britishness is, the charter is there in the marriage service in the prayer book of the Church of England, right? And that's a detailed account of what should be done and what conditions should be done and so on and so on. And that's completely been destroyed. And marriage has become a provisional arrangement between consenting adults. And you can see the breakdown of the institution in the figures of marriages breaking up, and that is divorces granted. Now people say, oh well, the law's changed. I said, no, the law's changed. I said, what I'm talking about? I'm talking about the change in the institution, right? Of course, there's reasons for it, right? So you can go and say, what happens, right? The Herbert Act there was the big jump there. Whatever, right? But you go from a state where in the country, out of all the millions of people marrying year after year after year, the number of divorces per year, a few dozen. At the end of the 19th century, actually, it became fairly easy to separate. But that's a... And you just see, again, exactly the same... Just the same trend with the breakdown in social order. You see the increase in divorces. They're just shooting up. Because the church... And again, it's the Church of England, in putting asunder in the 1960s, you didn't hear this, but I was discussing a similar point with Colin before we came in here. That there was the assumption that we now were a civilized society, a decent society, the paragon of the world, and everybody now knows. I mean, everybody's educated in the schools and so forth, right? Into a certain morality, and there's this great message of how successful we are. Lowndes, Silent Social Revolution that I study as a student in 1950. The wonderful work of civilising the English population. And it's been done. And we don't need these strict rules anymore. And in particular, all we're going to do if we lax the divorce, everybody now knows that the best and only thing to do is to get married and have children stay married, right? But there are these few people, Catholics in particular, few people who would like to get married and they can't because of the divorce rules. And so marriage will not be effective. This is all the argument of the time, by the way. This is what I was studying at the time. I was teaching the family at the time at the University of Birmingham and the University of Newcastle. And that was the whole spirit of the time, that we're home and dry, and therefore we don't need these rules anymore because everybody's going to know how to behave sensibly. Strong trend of what you call altruistic anarchism. Not egoistic, altruistic. The people left to themselves will do the sensible things. Well, there's the old, about the same time as the old Lonnie Donegan song, wasn't there, right? Where he gets the Rock Island line. He says, you know, I fooled you, right? I fooled you. That was the Church of England putting asunder. And you see then just the increase in crime. The only reason, increase in divorce, the only reason that it fades off, because there's not so many people getting married, like, is there? But on the other page is an interesting one, 16, and that is the role of women in welcoming the breakdown of marriage. Now, when I was younger, it was always regarded as being the man that's got to be shoved into marriage. Well, as soon as divorce becomes a possibility, an easy possibility, you see that the men just get divorced more or less at the same level. But you get this great change in the great surplus of women wanting to be divorced. That's just a kind of footnote. That's the wives of the soul. You see that one line on page 16 is divorce on the petition of or granted to the husband, which is the bottom line, and on the petition or granted to the wife. You see that women have grasped with two hands this possibility of escaping from the institution of marriage. And that's been made possible, of course, by the various bodged up jobs of saying, well, we'll give you this support, we'll give you that support, we'll give you the other support. And in the short term, that can look a good bargain. My wife used to teach adults at Southwick College, and she came home and she said, I bumped into Jenny in Southwick, she says, and she's got the baby, like, and I was so pleased, a bit backward, Jenny, like, but she had the baby, and she says, Mrs. Dennis, she says, don't tell anybody that I'm married, mind, don't tell anybody I'm married, because she wouldn't get so much money. So what we say is, we've asked for trouble and we've got it. And there's the number of children aged 0 to 15 at the time of divorce. And you see that every year there's 150,000 or so children under the age of 15 who have their their home disrupted by the adults who no longer abide by the old institution. And it's ridiculous to say that these things can't work, because, of course, they did work. Whether we can get back to it is well, I don't think we can, of course, but that's a most annoying thing that I get from academics. Also from current, it's always been the same, right? There's always been binge drinking. Well, of course, there's always been some people that binge drink, or whatever you say it, right? But the scale of the problem, the direction of the problem, is altogether different today. Oh, what about Gin Lane? What about Hogarth? I say, what about Hogarth? What about Gin Lane? I don't talk that way, of course. I talk in a calm, measured voice. I say, well, I think that Hogarth described the situation was very temporary. And by 1752, after various measures by the government, but it was in any case very much confined to London. It wasn't a national problem. And by 1752, they last got the Licensing Act that worked. And for a century, it was a general thing to say the blessed year of 1752, because it got rid of the problem. We're not even asking to get rid of the problem. We'd open the pubs for another 24 hours, right? So this business about it's always been the same, it hasn't always been the same. There's always been crime. Well, I know it's always been crime. But what about the garrotting scandals in London in the 1880s? Calm. Yes, I'm aware of the garrotting scandals in London. There was five or six people garrotted, and one was an MP, and it was stamped out in about 3 or 4 years, never heard of again. Now, it was exactly the same in the 1960s with abortion. Look, we've got all... are you saying that the flower of English motherhood, that your wife, your daughter, your mother, would behave improperly in regard to abortion? Right? There's a few girls still who don't know about contraception, and they're getting pregnant, and the figures were, I don't know what the figures were, well, you probably got the records, but I'd be interested to know what the highest figure that was ever quoted for backstreet abortions was.
1,000 a year.
Whatever, right? I mean, it was whatever. Put it as high as you like, put it at 50,000, whatever you like. But it was never in the never at the scale that we've got today. And the idea was, this is the argument, I mean, again, we're teaching this stuff at the time. The argument is, that look, we live in this successful society, right? Everything's going along hunky-dory. We've got the welfare state and all of this kind of thing. And we're renowned throughout the world for our decency and the English way of life, British way of life. And there's a few girls that are so benighted that they still haven't caught up, or the lads not being fair or whatever. And we've just got to bring them for the time being out of the back streets into the hospitals. And in a few years, it'll be zero, because obviously everybody's going to use contraception. Now, while everybody's using contraception, And then people say, young people have always misbehaved sexually. Calm, that's quite true, right? But there's certain indications that they're more sexually free today than they were in the past, because with contraception, right, you're still getting all of these conceptions. And these conceptions are being terminated. And there you are, 19, the abortion rate per 1,000 resident women aged 15 to page 19, you'll see that from as soon as it was made legal, it shot up to a figure far in excess of anything that was envisaged in the Act. And you can see that on page 20 then, as live births come down, abortions go up. In other words, the proportion of abortions per 1,000 live births go up all the time. I think I've got... I don't think... perhaps not. And quite typically, I know it's wonderful in Denmark and in Sweden and so forth, and the figures are higher there. But if we compare it with Germany, France, and Britain with Germany and France, you see that very, very typically, the British figure in the last few years has become worse than any other figure. See, it crosses over the France line there. I didn't used to allow my daughter to go on school trips to France in the old days. We knew what the French were. But anyway, we've now achieved that joke. We now achieved the distinction of crossing the. And as you can see, it's a mode of contraception, because on page 23, it's an hour now, so on page 23. You can see that it's mainly unmarried girls that are getting abortions. So those are the groups of single women, and never married without a partner, married with a partner, and then where they don't find out, and then that have been married but now widowed or separated or whatever, and compared with the... So put all the black ones together, whatever black ones you want together, certainly the first two together. And compare that with the abortions within marriage. You see, the abortions within marriage is a low figure. Right. Well, I'll just say a word then about police, the role of the police in all of this. To conclude, and that's literally 2 minutes. On page 24, so another thing that we're constantly told is that the police are at record numbers. What have you got to complain about? The police are at record numbers. And I've very rarely ever been applauded at any talk I've ever given. But I gave a talk to the Police Federation a couple of years ago at Blackpool at their annual meeting, and we were talking about this, and there was the mass ranks of the constables, and there was me in the Winter Gardens. And I said, well, all this stuff about the police being at record numbers, I said, it just reminds me of General Custer at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Right? And seven members of the... of the 7th Cavalry come galloping up, right, and the 7th Cavalry's at record number, so everything's okay. And all round the hills, like the Sioux were falling off the horses laughing. And I got what an outburst of applause I got for that. So that shows quite clearly, doesn't it, that on the scale, the increase in police numbers hardly registers. Enormous increase in crime, and you can I measure that by crimes per policeman, per police officer, I should say, per annum. And when I was born, every piece of Sunderland was patrolled every hour by a policeman and reported to the police box. Day and night, Every scrap of Sunderland was patrolled day and night by a policeman on foot. And the number of crimes that each police officer had to deal with per annum was 2. When I started work in 1952, a police officer had to deal with 8. When RoboCop, Ray Mullen, was born in 1957, it was still 8. When he started work, it was 19. When Tony Blair told us, my former leader, who I can't say I'm pleased to see that he's now distinguished himself as a socialist of the first water by taking a £500,000 job as a consultant with a large banking organisation, I wouldn't call it dismay, that's too strong for my temperament, but disappointment.
You voted for him, no?
That's true. He wouldn't be there but for me. In fact, I'll tell you a story. My son sent me something from the internet. He'd been browsing the internet, and he says, there's this article in Red Pepper, Dad, right? And it was by the librarian of London University at Russell Square. And when Blair was first appointed leader, apparently he sent over to the university for some books on socialism. So he'd mug up on what socialism was. This is the report, it's on the record, see? this is on the record. So he might be telling lies, but anyway, he's telling lies in the Red Pepper. And anybody can consult it. And the librarian says, this is the book we want, sir. English Ethical Socialism. So it's quite true. He misunderstood several of the things that I was arguing in that book. And so when Tony Blair said, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, each police officer was dealing with 36 crimes, and now it's deteriorated to 38. That's the progress that we've made on that one. And of course, with 38 crimes to deal with, in additional paperwork, and with patrolling, given the collapse in authority, requiring 2 policemen immediately doubles the manpower requirements for that particular activity, right? You have to be satisfied when all the glossy things on the internet and all the glossy things that come through your door about the police say, we're doing the neighbourhood policing is our priority, and everybody's highly satisfied with how many constables are now on the beat, supplemented by the community support officers, who, as you know, are notoriously now less inclined to deal with emergencies than an ordinary member of the public, in the classic case of those kids drowning, and of health and safety, that they couldn't intervene. So in other words, they'd been trained to be less competent than the ordinary member of the public. I think the final one just on the back there is a different way of putting that. And you see the crime numbers and police service strength at various years since crime began to increase. And you'll see that the white bar is the police strength and the black bar is the recorded crime. And you'll see that the police strength hardly increases in proportion to the job that they've got to do. So I'll leave it there and be very pleased to discuss these. Okay.
That may be new to quite a lot of people. There's one thing, Norman, perhaps you could talk about, and that's who commits the crime. What age? Are they male or women?
Well, it has been historically almost entirely males between the school leaving age, the final year at school, and and about 24, right? So it's young males who commit the crimes.
That's why your focus has always been on young men.
Young men, yes, of course. It's mainly young men. And that was historically the case. What's been happening recently is you're getting more crimes in the younger age groups now, while they're still in the... Because you've got a couple of years to take it. That's one of the weaknesses, actually, of the British Crime Survey, that they just take crimes that are that people over the age of 16 have experienced, right? Well, there's lots of kids now experience crimes, but those are not recorded by the British Crime Service. That's lost. I don't know what the magnitude of that is, so I won't say anything more about it. But that's just one of the basic point is that crime has historically been males, young males. What has been the prophylactic against crime has been marriage, fatherhood, children, and so on. That's why it's quite an important point that we're not getting bigger and bigger proportions of the population at risk. What the statistics of population at risk? We're not.
Could you talk more about that restraining influence? You said that marriage and the family are this restraining influence. Were this restraining influence on young men? You've talked about a time in your own recollection when. People thought that the young man was doing well if he, you know, got married and looked after his kids, and he thought that he was doing badly if he neglected those responsibilities.
Well, not if it looked when he was 12, if he's turned out the guy that would, the kind of person that would neglect those responsibilities. I'm saying that there was a very complicated process in which all ordinary members of the society participated. That people checked badly behaved kids in the street, right? That everybody, there was the consensus that this was the way in which men properly behaved, as far as civil society is concerned, in just these kind of things. But at the heart of it was this intense and very very complicated system, right? At the heart of it. Christian statements, these wonderful statements in the English language, in the Bible or in the prayer book or in hymns and so forth, that was saying this is the way that you handle sexuality, right? And that's all this about. So I do emphasise that it was a very complicated system in which there were many willing participants to see that it reached this result, and it's been dismantled. And what you get to kind of quote Burke again. Burke says the cunning and contriving politician can easily destroy what it passes his wit to rebuild. Right? You've got these complicated systems, and the thing that can fix it by this act and this measure and all of this kind of things, and it bears no resemblance whatsoever to a successfully operating institution. And we once had the successful institution of marriage, and we no longer have the successful institution of marriage. And even as compared with at least in 1991, if I may say so, the old conservative back to basics was partly based upon families without fatherhood. It was quoted in the Tory conferences and so forth. It was often quoted in those days. And it was laughed out of court. I mean, you know, it was. I think The Guardian showed Major in some ridiculous posture with his kind of Superman underpants on the top of his trousers and so forth. Anyway, he was just laughed out of court. Well, we're in a worse position now. I mean, thank God for something like the Christian Institute, or thank God for the Christian Institute that still soldiers on. But there's a dismemberment of the dismemberment of the institution of the family has gone very far.
Mm. You used to use this word social control in one of the talks you gave. And yes. You said that there was this is a technical term, there was this desire to produce this outcome of respectable male.
Yes.
But the desire isn't even there now.
Quite. And the teachers in the schools are more hopeless than anybody else. Again, if I could refer to my son, when he was 16, I remember coming down the steps. He came down from bed about 11:15, half past 11. He said, "I'm not going back to school at 16. Right? This is also, so I, in fact, put him in a Catholic school. Because the Catholic school was old-fashioned enough, like it was about 15 years out of date. I wouldn't have put it perhaps in a Catholic school 15 years before, but that was sufficiently out of date to say, well, you get a good education in their son, right?
How do we move from a council of despair?
How do you... how do you move from a council of despair? Well, that's the trouble. That's why I'm rarely asked back. like a lot of people in Sunderland that I know, they say, oh, I'm glad I'm going out and not coming in. So I'm afraid that I've psychologically long ago passed the baton to Colin here. No, I don't see any great... my wife stopped me getting papers, and she's got all kinds of parental controls on the on the computer. Because faced with real life, she sees me kind of getting my imitation of what I call, you know, one foot in the grave. She says it's too good an act like for her to feel comfortable with it.
I suspect that deep inside you, though, there is another council going on that is not a council of despair, that it's actually fundamentally something there that is hopeful. Obama.
Well, I'll think about that when I get home and I'll take a good look, but...
Okay, externalising it then. Where is the hope?
Well, I don't want to flatter my hosts, but this is a tremendous organisation. And this is a tremendous, tremendously successful effort. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the hope is this, that I've always said, well, one of my hopes, I know I always say, one of my hopes is when I arrive at the pearly gates and St. Peter says, you know, well, so we want to make it, and he says, well, why didn't you say something about it at the time? That when I say, well, I did, mate, I did say something at the time, and he let me in, right? That I've spoken and saved my soul. That's some kind of future. So that's one kind of thing. The other thing is, that you never know how public opinion is going to turn. It's a very, very strange thing. Think about smoking. Who would have thought that smoking would, you know, this creates... So when I was a lad, you know, whatever happened with the taxes, the old man, when a man of my age, had to have his baggy. That's a fact. You know, the biggest scandal of all, if the old man didn't have his baggy. And now smoking is a prohibited activity, almost. The coal and corner thing outside the bingo halls, like, you know, in the doors of the bingo halls. In these little huts outside dental hospitals and places like that. have you got a hut out there, Colin? So it's astonishing. So you don't know, and all you can do is to make your little continue. I mean, anything that I say, anything that Colin says, that is much more, of course, you were aware that is leverage, right? So leverage is a very important thing. My contribution is only a drop in the bucket, a drop in the bucket. This contribution today is a drop in the bucket. And I'll be serving I'm starting next week to serve actually on a commission on the police with Ray Mallon. That's why I mentioned Ray Mallon's, putting the thing, Ray Mallon's date of birth and Ray Mallon. So you keep on working. I used to go in the North Sea winter and summer, accounts for my, these trace elements which nobody knows about, right, have had their effect, see? And I used to think, well, when I went in on January the 3rd, you know, I said, well, this is warming the water up at Dieppe, you know. And if somebody's going in Dieppe, I've made my contribution. But anyway, lo and behold, you've got global warming. And it all creeps up on you. And things begin to look a bit better for people to go and swim in the sea. I'm just saying that it's a mysterious thing, public opinion. And there is a very good argument for just keep plugging away. And I must say, this is, you know, this, this, I, I'm, I'm, I've always loved the Christian Institute, but its present operation is really a model for optimism and for the kind of work that can still be done and can still have some prospect of gradual success.
Do you think consequences is an element of hope, in that you said that some of the slack has been taken up, and we have a vast sort of vast amounts of our taxes go to pay for the consequences of families without fathers.
Yeah.
But that can only mask some of the problems. Crime is still, a problem.
Well, quite. I mean, that's what I used to think, that I said we've asked the trouble and we've got it, and everybody can now see the trouble, and somebody will be going to be doing it. But the more trouble that we've had so far, the more kind of tinkering has been done. Herbert Spencer, who used to be a very famous and well regarded philosopher, he took a nosedive, but he used to say that, if you just look at somebody trying to knock out a piece of metal, right, and he knocks it out there and the bulb comes up here, right, and he says that that's an easy job for anybody compared with fixing institutions that have been allowed to be neglected. I mean, that's an enormous, the achievement of Christian Britain, the achievement of the decent Britain of the 1950s, whatever problems there were, of course, and those problems were being attended to, and some of the ways of attending have had these unintended consequences. But that achievement, is a work of centuries and longer, and it's all been tossed away in a very short time. It's been absolutely tossed away in a very short time. I think that John once gave me, when we were just talking about this, he referred me to the Venerable Bede, and when Augustine, I think, wrote back to Gregory and says, what have we got to do with these horrible sexual habits of the English? I said, 7th century, right? And he got a list of instructions, right? He said, well, I've got to see that they do this, and you've got to see that they do that, and it gradually, and there's it's built up, and it's built up, and it's built up. And then, in the 1960s, you get all kinds of things happening that in the 1950s, when the World Health Organization used to write to the ministries of the Interior, the Home Office in this country, and say, what's the drug problem? And the Home Office wrote in the 1950s, there is no drug problem. And then in the 1960s, just an avalanche, right? Just all like a dam bursting. Just all of these things just burst upon us. Partly, I must say, it's the result of the expansion of the universities. Right, we get all of these young people in the 1960s, away from home, in halls of residence and so forth. I remember Birmingham, the teacher in the lecturer in econometrics, a very good athlete, and I once went to the Lake District with him after I left Birmingham. I said, Matt, I said, you're looking great. I said, it looks like gold flowing through your veins, not blood. Oh, he says, it's marvellous. He says, the students are lining up for him. He kind of stood, and the whole thing. So they're all there, and then all these rules begin to change, and you get then all of this nonsense, this terrible hodgepodge of the Frankfurt School, that the problem is civilization, right? And all the kids, partly because they don't understand the language that's translated from the German, and they got and these are the people that are now in control, and you fire, and they used to talk about the transvaluation of values, okay? And there's never been a more striking case of the transvaluation of values, that everything that they opposed has been deposed, and everything that they advocated is now enthroned, and it's been a most astonishing cultural revolution.
Sorry, were you going to...
Yes, I just wanted to ask you about your diagram on page 15, where you've got you've got divorce doubling between 60,000 a year to 120,000 a year around the year 1970, I guess. And I was wondering if you could tell me why.
Well, that was the change in the law. That was a change in the law. So that big that leap in the middle of the
71 when the 1969 Act came in, wasn't it?
So the first big change. So that in 1858, the only way to get a divorce, until the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1858, the only way to get a divorce, that was the institution, that was the strength of the institution. And you say, well, that's got all kinds of bad results for individuals and so on. Anyway, you can argue about all of that and say that's got to be softened and whatever, whatever. But anyway, the fact is, until the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1858, you could only get a divorce by Act of Parliament. By private act of parliament, right? I think in 1920, in 1921, I think it was, the grounds were adultery. And I think before that, it was the adultery of the woman and the aggravated adultery of the man. That the woman couldn't divorce the man unless it was aggravated adultery of the man. But 1921, I think it was equalised, and that became a ground for divorce. In 1936, the Herbert Act produced the standard things, desertion, cruelty, and all of these kind of things. And then you had these big discussions in the 1960s, which culminated in the Divorce Act of... Divorce Act, I think it was called, was it? Or Matrimonial Causes Act, Divorce Reform Act, 1969. And that said that
right.
But before long, you then get that completely weakened, so it becomes, you know, no fault. Divorces. I mean, so marriage becomes a meaningful. You know, you've got more. If you're going to, you know, invest your life in this woman, investing your life in this man, you got better guarantees with Fenix, like.
People will say that the sharp
it just
rise,
goes, all goes.
The sharp rise in divorce following the changes in legislation shows that marriage wasn't that wonderful thing. Beforehand, they're all desperate to get divorced, but they just couldn't because of legislation.
That's what an institution is. It stops you doing what you want to do. Yeah.
that's exactly the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that there's still marriage, and the marriage, even if it was an unhappy marriage, there was still a marriage, and it still had its beneficial.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, that's what it's about. I mean, it's an institution, but you know,
it looks like it's the women who couldn't do what they wanted to do.
Well, there's a lot of men as well, of course. The men
leapt
at the opportunity to a certain extent. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
The more traditional values are expressed in some of our kind of ethnic minorities, aren't they? You
know? Yeah.
Is that good or bad?
Well, the values themselves I approve, right? But the package I disapprove of.
Mm. As much as, I mean, these are national figures, whatever kind of changes towards a traditional way are likely to be partial, aren't they? We're not going to get the entire nation deciding, well, we jumped over this cliff, let's find another one.
Yeah.
So it's going to be bits and pieces.
Sure.
And by far the most traditional set of attitudes.
Yeah.
With Islam. Hindus. And
well, the Jewish families remain strong as well.
Haven't they? Right.
Yes.
And the large growing traditional location.
Yes. I think the main effect of that is that because that's part of their package, and when they say you've got to assimilate the British values, I mean, excuse me? Yeah? So of course they're going to say that. You know, we want our daughters, you know, getting knocked off at the age of 13 to a quicker and more damaging extent than anywhere else in Europe. You know, so you want some of these values made. Oh, sure. So I'm saying that the whole package, of course, is highly oppressive to women, and you know, far beyond anything that was true of the British marriage in the 1950s, right? So it's a lot of reform to be done in the direction of equality. You know, in the 19th century. In fact, I think the Matrimonial Causes Act itself of 1858, if I'm not mistaken, but I might be mistaken, said that we're changing the legal notion of marriage as marriage under coverture, that is under the dominance of the man, right? And one flesh, but the man being dominant, to unity and partnership. I think it must have been later than 1858, actually. But anyway, a long, long time ago, I mean a century ago, at the least, we'd gone long past any Islamist custom of the man walking at the front and the woman, you know, shielded from the prying eyes of other men walking it paces behind them.
But the main drift of British marriage legislation from the 1756 Act is to put an end to clandestine marriages and the publishing of bans and this invitation for anybody, not just a member of the family, for anybody who
right.
wants to court.
Right.
Just to make sure it's
a public. It's a peculiar thing. It's essentially a voluntary act, but once that voluntary, it's a peculiar that voluntary act, once entered, it becomes a compulsory, you're a member of that institution, and you can't get out of it excepting under very strict.
I mean, the classic thing I think people should be aware of if they start reading it is Lawrence Stone, Road to Divorce. I mean, he says, well, oh, you know, there were marriage sales going on. Look at the amount of illegitimacy going on. You've got some very good counters to that, haven't you?
Yeah, well. I'll tell you the thing in Stone that I object to above all, and that is to say, well, divorce is the functional equivalent to death.
Yes.
That the age at the expectation of life at birth at the beginning of the 20th century was 51 for men or 53 for women or whatever it was, right? I think it was a bit lower than that. Expectation of life at birth, right? And therefore, if people get married at about 20, 25, right? The husband's dead by the time they're 40, like, so you only had 15 years of marriage. Well, the average time, you know, you get divorced. So divorce is, that's a complete, but and then it's quoted in all kinds of academic treatises, isn't it? And it's you hear it always in these discussion programs, and it's the most utter, blatant nonsense, isn't it? Because the expectation of life that's relevant is not the expectation of life at birth, but the expectation of life at 20. And the expectation of life at 20 at the beginning of the century, and in 1850 and 1800, was not very different from the expectation of life at 20 now. We've got another 8 or 10 or 12 years or something, but the expectation of life at 20 is the relevant thing, and people weren't popping off. People didn't die at 45, they died when they were 7 months old. And that was the expectation of life at birth. And the expectation of life at 20 is the relevant thing. And in any case, the idea that you can have a temporary thing, and you start with, oh, well, I'll get married because it's only going to last 15 years. You never don't do anything like that, except in the expectation it's going to last forever, do you? Right? It's a compulsory undertaking.
What about the arguments regarding sort of crime, in that we're always reading that it's to do with poverty? And, you can see a correlation with family breakdown and crime, but maybe it's because, you know, with a broken down family, you're more likely to be poor as a young male. And that's the reason you commit crime, not because you didn't have a dad.
Right. That strikes me as the most bizarre argument of the lot, and I'm sure you're not putting it forward as your own. Because we've never been a richer society. We're fabulously rich. You know, I think in the invention of permanent power, so what was housing like in 1950? Right? My wife, if you go to Sunderland, if you go to the football match, you'll see the old colliery terrace just that remains just outside of the Stadium of Light. And that's still there. And I courted my wife in 21 Southwick Road, and it came straight onto the pavement. And there was the pavement, and then there was the tram going past, like at bedroom height, and all the people kind of. There's the backyard, and then there's the back lane, and then there was the Colliery Railroad, and then there's the pit yard. So you put any washing out at you can imagine what it was like when you put any washing out in the backyard, all flecks of dirt straight away, right? Tap in the backyard. Right? Family of six, two bedrooms. Toilet down the backyard with the bits of News of the World I heard on the string. It was a noticeably respectable family that would have been absolutely horrified at any idea that the girls were going to get into trouble or that the boys were going to become criminals or anything like that. And the whole community supported them in that. The whole community supported them in that. And those streets were highly respectable, safe streets of very, very fine people. Indeed, partly because, of course, a lot of them were very clever people because they hadn't been selected to go to university.
Yeah.
Right? My mother-in-law said, "Sweet are the uses of adversity." It's like a jewel. And you quote, start quoting Shakespeare at the drop of a hat. But they were just left there in the community, and the communities were in control of the decent men. And there was a vast difference, of course, that people say, well, there used to be scrapping in the street. Well, if there was scrapping in the street, there would be a fight in the bar at the halfway house, right? Because somebody said, hey, you don't say that when my wife's here, right? In fact, I was talking to someone, I went on Sunderland Rambles a few months ago, and I was talking to a 74-year-old that was brought up in Springle, which is a colliery village, just outside Gateshead there. And he said, when I started work at 14, he says, I was absolutely astonished to find adults swearing. So he said, I thought it was just the older lads that swear. He said, I didn't think old adults swore. Right? He never heard swearing. Never heard swearing in the house. Never heard swearing. So someone else had fights to uphold community standards. Right? Vastly different from fights in violation of community standards. And that distinction's been prohibited now, hasn't it? So it can't be about poverty. And I was particularly interested in the invention of permanent poverty. So, well, what is about relative poverty? That was the invention of permanent poverty when you get richer and richer and richer, richer, right? Beyond the dreams of avarice, beyond the dreams of anybody in 1946 that we could be where. I used to think when I was, my wife suffered with pots to cover butter and pots to cover the milk and all that kind of thing. Because it was my theory that, you know, refrigeration is the job of retail shops. See? And everybody's got their refrigerator. I've got a refrigerator, haven't I, John? You've seen it.
Shame to say you have,
So, I used to think, you know, well, one of these days, you know, if we just go on the way we're going on now, even quite poor people can have a 10-year-old Ford Escort or something, Anglia. Everybody's got, you know, you get an ordinary street in Millfield now and you cannot get moved down the footpaths for motor cars. Like. So we've never been as fabulously rich as we are today. I mean, it's fantastic how rich we are. I mean, old Midas didn't have a look in. But in the book, I take a particular interest in what's happened to, well, is it relative poverty? And is it harder now to be poor? I mean, when these close communities and everybody was poor and everybody was sick, there was a kind of culture, almost of the glorification. Right? That, of course, I'm not going to... You have a tap in the house, like, you know, very soft. Get down there. Right? Bit of carbolic there. What's better than a bit of carbolic under the tap? So there's a kind of culture of glorification of fortitude and so forth. Which is not entirely a bad thing. So I look at what's happened with relative poverty then, right? But the fact is that since the war, since these figures began to rise, the gap between the reciprocals, open, closed, open, closed, open, closed, and the horizon's just gone straight past through them. Just gone straight past through. In any case, it's impossible for anybody to know what to change their behaviour because of their resentment about the gap. Because they can't experience the gap. They had to be told about this gap assiduously by Townsend and these people, right? Before it became a thing that could be put forward as a reasonable explanation for this bad behaviour. Which wasn't happening anyway because it was just fear and moral panic and so forth.
You mentioned how marriage in Islam is a more oppressive, it's never been, you know, what we think of as Christian marriage. And you mentioned a couple of times when you were speaking about the way in which Victorian values are denigrated now. That Victorian values is a byword for oppression. I mean, almost everybody here, you know, came through an education system and has lived under a media society where that is taken for granted. It is taken for granted that the 1950s and earlier, where you had this social control, that it was bad. Social control was bad. The enforcement of moral values was bad. It was oppressive. Uh-huh. People's lives were miserable. They
just couldn't
wait for freedom from this, you know, imposition of other people's moral standards, and that's why we're so much better off now. What do you say to people who...
Well, I mean, I've always been there's always been a tendency in my persona that's been attracted to libertarianism. That one of my mottos of life was nolo episcopari. You know that what that means? I do not wish to be a bishop. Right? I don't know the responsibilities of office. Right? I like to just go and come just as I please. I mean, liberty is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I think it's probably a fact. I mean, that's the basis of the requirement for socialisation and social control, that the normal inclination of us all is to do what we like and resent restrictions, so that when doing what we like is very pleasurable in the and especially in the short term to us, and the detriment falls on other people, right? There's a great temptation to say, "Oh well, this is better than ever," right? Because the detriment is falling on the children. And the detriment is falling on the general citizenry. The two things that I mentioned, right? That is what happens to children that are not brought up by the parents and their lack of achievement or their relative lack of achievement, and the effects of not socialising young men to be good fathers has upon the general behaviour of young men, and that is diffuse in the society. But that's my concrete personal pleasure now in having it off with his girl who seems to be willing to do so and so forth, right? And that's the immediate gratification to me, right? And the diffuse kind of thing, what effect is it on institutions and on the society and on the future, right? That used to have, that input had to be put in by oppression, by head teachers, by fathers, by mothers, right? You don't do, right? Of course, it was an oppressive society, if you say that it was that you were told that you can do that thing and you can't do that thing because of the results of doing that thing. And you don't see why it's bad, but I'm telling you that it's bad because I'm older than you, right? And I've got more experience than you. Just do I talk to my children, you know. Right? And the grandchildren. Roughly that's what it amounts to, though. There's people that... if I can quote Burke again, isn't it funny that I'm quoting Burke so much today? He says, I'm very reluctant to put people in charge of their own lives on the basis of their own experience, right, and their own understanding, because that's very, very limited. He says, what we've got to do is to take the benefit from the wisdom of the ages, right? from what common sense has told people over time and over time and over time that this is the right way to do. That was the common sense of the 1960s, which right? It says, well, that is the common sense thing. That's what everybody knows now. This is the way to behave. So we don't need these rules, right? And we just make these two or three adjustments to get shot of these obvious cases of oppression.
Were they really that miserable?
Yeah.
I would say,
that's a very, very difficult thing to get at now. I may not like to see any evidence that was ever produced to say that people on the average were more miserable or the poor were more miserable in the 1950s than people are today, I would think.
Were women beaten to a pulp?
Well...
Behind the front door?
What's the book by Roberts on the Salford slum? It's called The Slum, isn't it? Just called The Slum. There's a book by Robert Roberts on the Salford slum in the 1920s. Do you know the title of the book, John? Robert Roberts on the slum?
The Classic Slum.
The Classic Slum. It's called The Classic Slum. Robert Roberts, The Classic Slum. And there's that book on the Classic Slum. And in the 1970s, he always had all my colleagues were saying, oh, well, it's all the women were beaten to the pulp by the men, you know, as Robert Roberts shows in The Classic Slum. Well, all I say is, go, excuse me, calm. Go and read The Classic Slum. See? And what Roberts actually said was that, of course, there was a few men who, when they got drunk, treated their wives and children harshly. But they were despised by the population, right? And so on and so forth. So, of course, there was some... I would guess that there's at least a high proportion of women being beaten by men, as there ever was, because you're much more likely to beat, you know, this temporary partner who, you know... I think that there is very little evidence that there was widespread.
I can remember my parents saying, "Don't have anything to do with that man. You know, he treats his wife badly."
Well,
this is, whatever.
And I mean, I think there's a very, very strong element in the culture that a man doesn't hit a woman. A man would never hit a woman. I'm talking about a lad that was brought up in the roughest part of Sunderland.
So what about this little awkward thing, or this huge propensity of women to take advantage of the divorce legislation?
Well, because if the constraints are removed and they're invited to do so, they're going to do so, because the costs fall on other people. And especially with the strength, the way that which the Institute broke down, I mean, I think that there is, timidity in relation to any lady that's present, I think that men have really got a raw deal in the whole business. Do you know the famous, how many divorced men does it take to change a light bulb? You know that joke? Nobody knows, because he never gets the house. So women, it's been a good bargain for women. It's definitely been a good bargain for women. Let's compare with men.
My father would thrash us and my mother.
Would he really, John? That explains a lot about your funny words.
why you beat
Jean so mercilessly.
It's quite right, yeah. That's why she's there. But I mean, her sisters wanted to divorce him, and she wouldn't do that because of the stigma in the school, and in the village in North Wales and things like that. Now, I'm sure if the access to divorce had been as ready, easy, whatever word you want to use now, she would have done that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
She was having a rough time.
Yeah.
And obviously many tens of thousands of women were.
Well, I'm sure that all of us have had occasions when we thought, well, so-and-so's always like this, blah, blah, blah. But you take the principle that if you feel that you're not going to talk to them for 2 days, like, then in 10 minutes you would have forgotten what the argument was about, right? And if you want to leave them, you know, it'll take about 2 hours before you forget what the argument was about. So, but I mean, people do respond to difficulties in relationships in a way that exaggerates their own. In fact, I also say in relation to committee work, that you've got to have a committee because 99% of the time I know I'm right in any argument with you. The difficulty is in the same arguments, 99% of the time you know that you're right, okay? That we all exaggerate our own interest in this thing. So given the opportunity, people are going to choose individual choice, aren't they? As long as you can blow the consequences and the detriment to other people without...
see these large tens of thousands of women in quite that disparaging light.
I'm not talking about women, I'm talking about us all.
Yeah.
I made a general statement about human nature.
What was it like for everybody in those days? I think there's a bit of a problem that these institutions weighed more heavily on some than on others.
Well, that's of course that's something that
that might be a bad thing.
I'll just say this, that this is a familiar argument, and about the division of labour, and when people say, oh, well, the men had it easy and all that kind of thing, you're not arguing that. Well, can I put the point nevertheless, because it's a good point. This is what's known in logic as, I think, ignoratio elenchi. That's answering a question that's not being put. Which is when people say that the women had a bad deal, I think in the industrial working class they didn't have a bad deal. And when feminists in the college used to say a few years ago, and I don't know if it exists anymore, as an opinion, that men had it easy, I say that the women were gasping to get into the shipyards and get inside the boilers with the acetylene lamps and just to lie there for 4 hours, right, with all the sparks falling on them and all the fumes, right? And the men, they were clamming to get out in the pit, right, to go through the tunnels and deal with the pick and shovel right in the 1930s, but with very difficult heavy machinery, right? There was a division of labour based upon the fact that it was a very hard life for the men, right? And it was also a hard life for the women, but it was a division of labour that, because of children, right, meant that the women saw the hard work in the home and the man saw the hard work outside. And I don't think it was there was anything in this business of it being an easy life in the ordinary industrial working class, where it's 65% of the population, right? It was easy for the men and not for the women. It was hard for the men, it was hard for the women. It was a division of labour, which was in all the circumstances, a reasonable division of labour. And if anything, the women had it easy.
John, I'd like to ask you if you think that women are less prone to violent behaviour by men under the current marital setup, where basically you move from man to man, than they would have been on average in a situation where they were stuck with the same bloke for life.
That's the point they've already made, John, but that's being put again. Mm. A question I want.
What do you think you say that the values, a few generations ago, of a young man leaving school age between that and getting married, whereas, to be a man who was worthy of marriage, and the whole community would have supported him in that. Well, what are the values of a male now aged between 15 and 25? What are the values in our society now for him?
By the way, I don't say it began at 15. The whole point is it begins when? 2 months. Begins at, what you do about the baby crying or whatever, So it's a lifetime thing. Essentially, it's a lifetime thing. And by all participants, sufficient participants in a consensual society to make it work. Well, what about youth today? Well, I think there's been an enormous polarisation. That I talk to plenty of young men and women that have got kind of attitudes and skills and what you'd roughly call intelligence, that couldn't and achievements. I mean, what they do. When I was a fairly athletic young man, I think that most of us wouldn't think it was physically possible to run a half marathon. And my daughter now does the Ironman in Hawaii and the Ironman in Austria and all of this kind of thing. So there's a great spreading out, right? And some people have taken enormous advantage of all of these possibilities, right? And other people taking no advantage at all. Did I tell you the story, John? I've seen you since I was going up with the Age Concern in Stockton Road, and I was in the Sunderland bus station just a few weeks ago. And I heard these three lads, and I was trying to work out what nationality they were. And anyway, I went in the toilet, they went in the toilet at the bus station there, and I'm listening, right, as they talk, and I'm trying to, I can't understand. So anyway, I come out, and I walk up towards Stockton Road, I'm still listening to them, I'm still kind of, you know, nosy, couldn't come, so they sent me. And I'm listening, I honestly just decided that they were Albanian, I couldn't understand, right? And then I heard them say one or two things that were happening, and I realised it was the most degraded Sunderland that I'd ever heard. And you realised, and by the look of them, you know, but you realised that given the fact that they're going to be fed, they're going to be supervised in the school, they're going to be fed in the school, take no interest whatsoever in school, they needn't do so, right? They're going to be fed, they're going to be housed, they come from homes where there's, you know, where there's never anybody work. And really, all they've got to do is to have some communication that shows antagonism we want towards outsiders and solidarity to the temporary insiders. And they had no more use for a developed language than a tribe of baboons. Tremendous, right? And, you know, down through the respectable fields of Millfield, streets of Millfield, that on a Friday and Saturday, the so-called ski run, right, where they're just coming down from the, getting more and more drunk as they can get the town centre, right? So there's a terrible amount of very, very bad, self-destructive behaviour. Of course, you've got all the problems of drugs, which has been an interest of mine for some time, which have disappeared also for two or three years. And it shows, all of these things show in the figures as well, don't they? They're showing the figures.
You said that in the 1950s in Butlins you saw a change from 1 year to the next.
In Butlins, yeah.
And you hear on Radio 4 the government schemes for how to deal with some of these problems is to get children into school from an earlier age and from an earlier time in the day until later, and provide childcare and provide things for children to do. Essentially, you're saying that's actually part of the problem, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's part of the problem, but I just agree with you completely. But it's part of this. Part of the problem also is that you're bound to deal with the hard cases. We now live in a compassionate society, and we more and more adopt laws and adapt the situation to deal with the hard cases. The old wisdom was that hard cases make bad law. Right? Hard cases make bad law. But nowadays you can't say, well, somehow the society has got to cope with this without this new arrangement, because this new arrangement will simply embed the problem into the system. The modern media are very, very ill-equipped to deal with any complicated argument or any bigger picture. And the convincing thing is, oh, there's this hard case, and now you say nothing should be done about it. You're stumped, aren't you?
I remember you saying about girls who got pregnant, and there were some who got pregnant when you were growing up. There was tremendous stigma against illegitimacy. yet.
Yes.
I mean, you were asked the question, you know, how were they treated?
Well, you're reminding me of an occasion when the BBC radio, the BBC programme was on at 5 o'clock, the radio programme was on at 5 o'clock tonight. What is it called? PM. And anyway, they said that they wanted to do a programme on working class life. And I said, I'll get some of my relations and some of the neighbours to talk about working class life as it was and the community life that they knew it in Millfield. And so she came up and she was actually diverted on the way, but had to be postponed the next day because she'd been sent to Middlesbrough to sit in this house with the microphone while the kids arrive. Oh, they're coming now, these kids at 5 o'clock, they've come into the garden, oh, they're setting fire to the outhouse now. And it goes on and they say, oh, we're going to have to call the fire brigade now. Right? And anyway, they came up to Millfield and they were talking about working class life in Millfield. And this young interviewer, she was a nice girl, she says, but surely those are middle-class values. Right? Funny view of what working class life was like. Eh? I said, yeah, a lot of people kind of thought that a lot of the things that middle-class people did was good, like, you know, family and all that kind of thing. And anyway, she says, but this business of the... it must have been terrible to be an illegitimate child. And Jenny Heron says, oh yes, it was terrible, you know. And she mentioned the girl across the road. She says, you know, that disgrace. And she said, so that treated them badly. Oh, no, she says, we all knitted the band clothes. And Mrs. Douglas used to take down the girl down, the dinner down with a plate over it, you know, and we looked after our own. That is, they did everything they possibly could to stop it. But when it happened, you looked after your own. So it was a kind of family situation. That is, you do everything to see that your son or your daughter doesn't misbehave. But if he does misbehave, at any rate, you know, the family is the place where they're going to be treated in a loving and detailed way forever, really. And it was like that. And so I thought it was a good example of how the system worked, that we thought was... They wouldn't forgive the girl that got pregnant in Rutland Street. Like, they wouldn't forgive the girl that got pregnant in John Connolly's Road. It was terrible streets, right, and terrible people. But if it happened in Booth Street, then you're treated in a kind of family way.
And now the state takes care of the consequences.
Yeah.
Or doesn't really. Well, thanks very much, Norman. We're very, very grateful for you. And I'm sure it's been quite an education for many people.